Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Glad to have you with us on what is, if you're listening in real time, the Friday edition of the show. Everybody here in the studio and our panelists down in Macon, Chris Grant, who we'll introduce more formally in a minute, all looking forward to a big weekend. Galloway, the last time we talked to you about the weekend, last week you were getting set to spend the weekend in the yard, but not tomorrow.
No,
tell
not
everybody
tomorrow.
What you're going to do. This is Jim Galloway, of course, the lead political writer for the AJC. What's your day tomorrow? Pretty interesting.
I am flying down to Amelia Island to talk to the Georgia Psychiatric Physicians Association. It seems as if we have something in common. We have both discovered that people aren't necessarily rational creatures.
This has nothing. They are not meeting in any way or inviting you down in any way to discuss or assess what a lot of mostly Democrats out there have been doing, assessing the president, the state of his mental health.
Oh, no. They may be assessing mine, but
okay. You just want to be. I don't want our listeners to reach some conclusions. Loretta Lepore is back with us. It's Friday. She is has been a Republican political consultant. She was also the press secretary for Governor Sonny Perdue long before he went off to Washington to be ag secretary. She was the co-chair of Carly Fiorina's presidential campaign in the state of Georgia. You doing anything as interesting as Galloway this weekend, Loretta?
No, I'm going to take a lower profile this weekend.
Okay. And we're really pleased to have Stacey Evans back in the studio with us. Stacey, it's been a while. I think the last time you were here was before you announced you were a candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor. And at that point, you know, we try not to have active candidates in, but we're really glad you're back. I guess you'd rather be out on the campaign trail as the gubernatorial candidate, but you can say whatever you want now on the show.
That's right. I'm a little bit more free, right? And of course, it was a hard-fought campaign, but now I'm happy to be out on the campaign trail for Stacey Abrams and looking forward to turning Georgia blue.
I want to talk to you about that in a second and bring everybody into the conversation. But first, let me go back to mentioning, I mentioned Chris Grant at the very beginning of the show. He's the chair of the political science department at Mercer University in Macon, and he joins us from our bureau down in Macon. How are you, Chris? You got big weekend plans?
I'm doing great. This is the first weekend my kids are back in school, so we'll be doing laundry and homework and all those fun things.
Sounds like great fun. Well, thank you for being here from our Macon office, Chris. Stacey, let me, if I may, start with that. You and Stacey Abrams fought a good battle for the Democratic nomination. One of the things you did that was so interesting, of course, is that you staked out somewhat different approaches to winning Democratic voters, not just in the primary, but thinking ahead to the general election as well. How you're now on board with Abrams, but the question that's been raised, since we haven't had a chance to talk to you about it, is has she staked out a position that you feel comfortable will appeal to the broadest general election electorate out there? Is she running as a liberal in a way that you think makes it a little trickier for her? How do you feel about all that now?
She's running a campaign that puts Georgians first, and I think it's been very clear since we've completely left the primaries behind. Of course, we left our primary behind a long time ago. I immediately endorsed and have been enthusiastically pushing Abrams and Democrats all across the state. But we're now past even the Republican primary runoff. And since it's been Abrams and Kemp out there, you've seen Abrams talking about jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You've seen Kemp and Republicans throwing stones, personal attacks at Abrams. Georgians want a governor that's going to fight for them and not just fight for political points. And so I think that Abrams is running a fantastic campaign right now, and I'm confident that she'll be in the governor's mansion in January.
You're suggesting that she's being much more pragmatic in terms of pushing issues you think will be appealing to more Georgians, that she isn't going to stick to that more liberal philosophy that she seemed to be expressing during the primary.
Well, the thing that was frustrating for me during the primary, and I'm sure was frustrating to Ms. Abrams as well, was people are always trying to put a label on what you're doing. I think we had different theories of strategy in the general election, but it all came down to pushing progressive values that were going to put people to work, make our schools better and make sure that folks are able to go see doctors when they're sick. And you can call those whatever you want to. Those are the things that she's talking about, and those are the things that Georgians want to hear about. And that's why I think she's well on her way to victory.
Yeah, I'm curious as to what you think. What the difference is now on the Republican side. What would Stacey Abrams have been facing with a Casey Cagle there, and how different is that from what she now faces with Brian Kemp?
Well, it's hard to say, right, what Cagle would do since we don't get to see. Mm-hmm. But I suspect that Cagle would have been doing a little bit more of what Abrams is doing right now, talking about jobs, talking about the economy. I'm surprised that Kemp mm-hmm. is continuing to just be uber partisan and lob attacks. I think that Cagle would have been taking a different tact. And I think it's great that Kemp is doing what he's doing. I think it's going to end up hurting him in the end. But we get to see this campaign where he doesn't seem like he's going to move off the far right position that he staked out during the primary election.
Loretta, let's get a Republican response to that. But before we do, let me remind everybody we're live now on Facebook. So just go to the GPB news page on Facebook Live and join the conversation that's going on there. Watch the show. We've already got a number of people who are weighing in, and we always love to hear your comments. For instance, Christopher Lee Raley introduced himself, Loretta, today by saying, "I'm a Russian bot here to influence your simple liberal minds." Thank you, Christopher.
Right.
Anyhow,
I saw that.
How do you, when you hear Stacey's comments, what's your reaction?
Well, first, I want to cross the partisan divide for a moment and thank Stacey for putting herself up for public service and for her time that she spent in the Georgia legislature. I think all too often we don't recognize those who put themselves up, particularly in this political environment. And so I thank you for that.
I think on
the point with Casey Cagle and where he might be at this point in time is I think we'd continue to hear him talking about some of the issues that Stacey talked about on the campaign trail with relation to those students who don't pursue a four-year education and perhaps are looking at going through a career academy or approaching dual enrollment. And those were big issues for him, which he would probably come out of the box again talking about. I think the difference here is, Stacey, you mentioned that Stacey Abrams is putting put Georgia first, put Georgians first. Well, that's been Brian Kemp's mantra all along.
You forgot hardworking.
Hardworking.
Which is not an incidental matter. It means something.
That's a little bit of a whistle there.
Right. Well, it does mean something. And I think that it is also a point of how they nuance this, because we're seeing a lot of money coming in from outside. And Stacey Abrams clearly is running a dual campaign, a Georgia campaign and a national campaign. She has utilized the national media to great effect in terms of fundraising in both the primary and now. And so, when she says putting Georgians first, what does that mean? I think on the issues of jobs and the economy, clearly Republicans have a lot of proof points, right? And Brian Kemp is going to be able to run on those proof points. We have a AAA bond rating. We've got a great jobs report. We've got, this week, I think the Department of Economic Development released investment numbers, $5.5 billion of investment. So there's good economic times in this state. And Republicans being both in the leadership in the governor's office and in the legislature can use that to run on this year.
All right, I want to pick up on something Stacey mentioned. And Chris, I'm glad we have a political scientist on the show today, because Stacey mentioned that one of the things that's frustrating is the labels that many of us, and in the media in many cases, tend to put on the ideology or on the positions that candidates take. So Chris, here's my problem. When Kemp and Abrams became the two general election nominees, before Stacey Abrams started shifting to this more pragmatic line of thought, I was having a hard time figuring out. I would say on the air, they both represent the further ends of their party. Stacey Abrams is a liberal. Brian Kemp is a more extreme conservative. Those aren't correct labels. And yet, the two of them do represent. How do you characterize what they have represented in terms of those ends of their party?
Well, we've been looking at the American political party system moving apart for the last 50 years, we used to have the Democratic Party that had the most conservative and the most liberal members of Congress, and the Republican Party was a moderate party that was in the middle, and they kind of figured it out in between them. Since the advent of Ronald Reagan, even before that, that's shifted. And so I think that the perception of the two candidates as being more to the base or the extremes of the party's system certainly helped in the primaries. But that's probably not where the average Georgia voter would like to see their next governor be. And I think Stacey Abrams has astutely moved to the center, and I would expect Secretary of State Kemp to do the same.
Oh, I think Kemp is already doing that. I mean, you saw just yesterday or the day before where Governor Deal unilaterally suspended the jet fuel sales tax on behalf of Delta and the other airlines over at Hartsfield. And Brian Kemp, who in the spring had condemned Delta for being a corporate coward or a cowardly corporation.
I think that was it.
That was something there. He lined up right behind Nathan Deal this week and said that suspending that tax was a good move that would help the state's economy. Now he's saying he's not shifting. I think that's a shift.
I think it's a shift. And I also think if you look at who Brian Kemp was in the General Assembly and sort of his background, he's from Athens, which is not really known for being the conservative center of Georgia. He's an Episcopalian. I mean, not known for being the most fervent of social conservatives. I think you would expect him to drift back toward the moderate center. And quite frankly, Stacey Abrams in the legislature was very effective at making compromises with Republicans.
Jim, let me turn to you on it. Let me move this into some of the news that we saw in the gubernatorial campaign trail this week. You all in the Political Insider, and by the way, we always want to remember to mention that, you are, not only does your column appear in the Wednesday and Sunday AJC, but you oversee the Political Insider, which is on the myajc.com website. You had an interesting item about Josh McCoon down in Columbus, a state senator, lost his bid for the GOP nomination for Secretary of State. But he decided to give Republicans some advice on his Facebook page or his Twitter.
This was on his Facebook page.
Okay.
Yes,
And what was that advice, and why does it matter to us today?
Well, the advice was to lay off Stacey Abrams and criticism of Stacey Abrams' personal finance. She's reached a deal with the IRS. She's kind of about $54,000 behind on payments. She's got a payment plan going there, carrying maybe $170,000 in student loan debt, I think. And McCoon basically said, stay away from this. You've got too many Georgians who are very much in the same situation as she. And when I called him yesterday morning to ask him about this, and, he in that post, he did not mention Nathan Deal. But when we talked, I mean, one of the first things he told me was, if you remember, 8 years ago, Nathan Deal was the Republican nominee. And only after he became the nominee did we really find out how precarious his personal finance position was. And part of it was because he had underwritten a loan for his daughter and son-in-law to open a sporting goods business. And that debt was going to come through 2 months, 1 month after he took the oath of office. Okay. So McCoon says he remembers it was a very hot Georgia day in October down in Columbus, and reporters started asking him about Nathan Deal, and it wasn't that terrible. And he says, well, he's helping out a family member. He's helping out his daughter. And there, but for the grace of God, go I. So, and then what he said was, it just seems inconsistent to apply, not to apply the same rule to Stacey Abrams.
Yeah, Stacey, I want to ask you about that, because I think we did learn back that, the media, I wasn't doing political reporting during that campaign, but I certainly remember the reporting in those days was, my gosh, this could completely sink Nathan Deal's general election campaign. This is a significant issue that he's having these financial difficulties. Well, that didn't come about. And I wonder, you may not have been thinking about that in the back of your head, but your campaign during the primary did not go out of its way to highlight this issue of the problems that Stacey Abrams was having.
Well, and I think to Jim's point and to Josh's point, there are a lot of folks out there with debt. A lot of folks can sympathize with someone trying to help a family member. I know I've certainly co-signed many loans for family members, and that I ended up on the hole in the bag and paid those things back. But everyone can sympathize when something like that goes awry. And I think what Josh was trying to say, trying to give some really sage advice, if I might compliment him, is don't be a hypocrite. Because not only did you have these issues in 2010 with Nathan Deal, and not only do you have this conundrum that a lot of the voters are going to have similar problems and you don't want to be insulting them, but you also have something not unsimilar with Brian Kemp. I mean, he personally guaranteed a $500,000 business loan that came due, and he didn't work out a payment plan to pay it back like Abrams did with her debt. He's having to be sued for it. So I think it was a good warning to say, don't get too far out there on this, Republicans, or you're going to have egg on your face.
You know, one of the big changes I've seen in politics, Bill, over the last 20 years is voter attitudes toward personal finances, and I think you have to lay it at the foot of the Great Recession. It too many of us suffered for that too many of us know that the economy isn't always in your hands to control.
Right. Well, it was pervasive. It impacted everybody. And I think I agree with you about voters. And that's what I was going to say is that, you know, two things that we know about Stacey Abrams. One is that she's very smart, and it was tactically very smart to get this issue out very early in the campaign. And two, she's very articulate. So she was able to speak to it in a way that resonated with everybody. Right. Everybody understands that. It's not as though she tried to somehow couch it or conceal it. And now we're at a point where it's been raised. It's been discussed. Republicans have weighed in on it. And it's up to the voters to decide what they feel about it at this point. And I think Josh McCoon's point, too, we've got other things to talk about and we've got other ways to discuss why Brian Kemp is a better candidate than Stacey Abrams. Let's get down to that business.
Let me move on to the Brian Kemp side of this race, if I can. And Loretta, let me start with you while you have the ball. I've had already on Facebook Live a number of people who have heard this news report that I think Drew Dawson gave right before we came on the air about a report from the McClatchy newspapers on the fact that Georgia, the McClatchy reporting says that Georgia's done very little to secure its voter data after the 2016 incident, in which we all know a benign hack exposed the fact that the system was very, very, very vulnerable. Now, the McClatchy report is nothing new. It is a national organization reporting to its readers around the country, something we've already covered pretty extensively here. Still, there are a number of organizations, the NAACP, the ACLU, who believe that Brian Kemp should resign his office on the theory that you cannot oversee an election in which you are a candidate. I get that, but I think we should have a conversation about the fact this isn't something that one Republican candidate has done. This is the way the system has worked.
Right. So two issues there. On the hacking issue, right, that is an old story, and things have been done since that time to rectify that situation and to put in security measures. On the second issue, with regard to the NAACP's contention that Brian Kemp ought to step down, there wasn't an issue when Brian ran the first time. He was Secretary of State. He was appointed by Governor Perdue when Karen Handel stepped down to run for governor. So he was Secretary of State when he ran the first time for Secretary of State. He also was a Secretary of State when he ran the second time. And there are others, such as Kathy Cox with a C, who was our previous Secretary of State, who also stayed in office while running for governor.
And Max Cleland, I believe.
Yeah, Chris, it really becomes impossible. I mean, I suppose you could have some sort of independent election oversight board, but it really becomes impossible. I get why the Democrats would want to use, or some Democrats might want to use this, but I don't know how you would manage this system otherwise. What do you think?
Well, I'm going to speak as a political scientist, but I have to give Jim one quick correction. Max Cleland had to resign to run because the law was in place in 96. That was one of my Senate races for my dissertation, so I remember that one. know that one well. I wonder sometimes why we elect so many people statewide as it is. Wouldn't it be better to have a professional Secretary of State? Wouldn't it be better to run the governor, lieutenant governor on a ticket and trust their judgment in making appointments? Because in many ways, I think that's a better model of running things. But we don't do it that way. We elect our Secretary of State. Most of the mechanisms of elections are actually controlled by professionals in the Secretary of State's office. Secretary of State really doesn't get into the tampering or the counting of votes on an individual basis. I don't have a whole lot of worry over what may be going on. What worries me sometimes a bit more is that we contracted out our voter registration, our voter database to someone else. I kind of wonder about the wisdom of doing that. And I don't think that's necessarily a Republican or a Democratic issue. It's an issue that we all are facing when the government tries to save money by moving things out of their own accountability in their own hands. Well, and that does open up the door to some risk.
Stacey, the McClatchy piece does say that they've seen no evidence that Brian Kemp himself, but Kemp in the McClatchy piece it is characterized as not having known about this at all. He knew, of course, he learned about the breach. What the McClatchy piece says is that that happened in 2016. In 2017, a report went out saying that the breach had not been fixed. There was still a vulnerability there. Kemp says he never heard about that, and so McClatchy is sort of dinging him for not being more on top of this whole thing.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of questions there about the competency with which he's run the Secretary of State's office. And while I agree with what has been said here, the Secretary of State oversees the election. We've had Secretaries of State stay in office before. Someone's got to be in charge, and typically they're going to be on the ballot. But we need to have those checks and balances, whether it's the State Board of Elections or what have you, that is overseeing. But I think the real concern here is the Secretary of State that we have. There's not a lot of confidence that he is overseeing the office in the way that he should. We know that personal information has gotten out before. We know there was the issue with the servers at Kennesaw State. So there is concern, not maybe perhaps it's being talked about in the position that he has and the fact that he's on the ballot. But I think the real concern here is with the competency of Brian Kemp, and that's manifesting itself in different ways.
Well, Jim, you have to imagine that what Stacey Evans is saying at some point, we've talked about the fact that so far Abrams has chosen to run a positive campaign focusing on issues she thinks everyday Georgians, I think that's a language she might use, will find appealing. At some point, they're going to turn. They're going to have to.
This is an old argument within Georgia political circles, but it's also it's got some new twists. And just given the situation with Russian hacking and the attention that's being given to the security of our election system, and the fact that we are woefully behind in updating our voting machines, everybody agrees with that. And I'm sure there's going to be some discussion in the race for Secretary of State over what kind of machines and what kind of systems need to be replaced. I think this is going to become an issue that Brian Kemp is going to have to deal with in some fashion or another.
Loretta, I can't help but wonder whether Brian Kemp or Stacey Abrams wins this election, whether, given all the controversy, all the questioning about the security of our election apparatus, whether there are going to be voters out there, individuals in the state of Georgia, who in the back of their mind wonder if this election was adjudicated without interference in any way.
You mean at the state level?
Yeah, I don't mean I'm suggesting that I think there are probably people who are going to wonder whether or not the election results are honest and accurate. And
I think that is a prevailing concern.
Right.
And I think, you know, Brian Kemp has set up this SAFE commission coming out of the legislative session where they tried to pass legislation this last year to put in a new voting system, which is a requirement by law because currently the current law only allows us to have the system that we have today. So following the session, he put together the SAFE commission, which is a representative of folks that work work in this field, including cybersecurity experts. And there was a tremendous amount of testimony at the first meeting. And a lot of the testimony came from individuals.
Yeah.
And folks that work on the ground, maybe work the polls on election day. And there is concern about our system and what kind of paper trail we do or do not have. Currently, we don't have one. So I think that's something that's persistent. That's something that I think everybody in the state recognizes is an issue, in particular Brian Kemp, because he's dealing with it every day.
Yeah, but Stacey Evans, before we get to a break and before people start tweeting me, I am not suggesting that it is Brian Kemp. I'm not suggesting a fingerprint from a Brian Kemp or somebody in the Secretary of State's office. Just in the broader way that Americans have less faith, probably, in the outcome, in the accurate counting of elections than ever before.
I agree. And it's very important that we get our hands around this and we update our antiquated voting system. And we put safeguards in not only at the federal level, but the state level. And right now you have a lot of Republicans resisting this because they've been on the winning side, both here in Georgia and obviously the last presidential election. And there's so much caught in this fight about whether we're saying the election was illegitimate because we have these concerns about hacking. And the bottom line is we have concerns about hacking. You may be the beneficiaries of hacking tomorrow, but the victim of hacking tomorrow. So the bottom line is we need to get it right so that no one is going to be a victim. Because if this is going on, it could very well hurt the Republicans just as much as
exactly.
folks believe it's hurting the Democrats
now. Thank you for saying that better than I did. All right, I've got to get to a break. When we come back, we've got a bigger hacking issue that Jim Galloway, in a column that he wrote just the other day, brought to light that I want to get to. It's not about Russians hacking the election, Jim Galloway. Yes, that probably will happen again. We have seen evidence of it. It's about whether the Russians are in our electric grid. And we'll talk about that after this break.
Hey, this is David Green, host of Morning Edition. I'm here to talk with you about that poking feeling, the one that keeps reminding you to support public radio. You can support the programs you love by donating your used vehicle. That old car or truck could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station. All you have to do is call, and you might even receive a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR, and thanks.
Jim Galloway, this past week, suddenly a lot of national attention has focused on the fact that there is evidence that the Russians have tried to tamper with the power grid in places in the United States. You wrote about it in part because your entry point was the president of the Southern Companies, which, of course, owns Georgia Power, Alabama Power, Florida as well, I believe.
Mississippi, too.
Mississippi. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what you wrote and what the significance is.
Yeah, well, this was kind of a prelude to Tuesday's a kind of a cyber summit in New York, where you had the heads of all the U.S. Intelligence agencies and some of the top business executives of the nation kind of talk about where hacking was headed next. And, you know, generally we've got some reports out there now saying that Russians are less interested in monkeying with our midterm elections than they are in probing our electrical grids, because it is probably a more direct threat to the nation. And how that column came about was that I was going to the Atlanta Rotary Club on the expectation of meeting Bob Corker, but I was a week too early. I was a week ahead, and so instead, Tom Fanning was the speaker. He's the CEO of Southern Company, and he gave kind of a sneak peek at that summit meeting and where Southern Company was headed and the levels of defense that they had established. You know, he told them that they've got an energy management node at an undisclosed location in Birmingham, another one at an undisclosed location in Georgia. If those fail, they've got something that they call Operation Spare Tire that will get us maybe 70% of the way there. You won't be freezing to death in your home.
I think you reported that they're prepared to take the whole system off the grid entirely.
That is Project MacGyver. That's what Fanning called that one, taking it completely off the grid. The problem here is they haven't done that since the 1950s, and everybody who used to know how to do that is dead.
Oh my God! Hey, Chris Grant, here's one of the things that I'm curious about here. I mean, we're speculating, of course. But, you know, the president, of course, has been reluctant, as we all know, to talk about Russian meddling in the 2016 election and really doesn't want to say much about whether the Russians may meddle in 2018 as well. We all think, well, that's because he thinks it would delegitimize to some extent his victory. This doesn't have anything to do with the president's winning or losing election. So I wonder if President Trump might be motivated to actually want to get involved in this whole question of whether the Russians are involved in our electric grid or whether his relationship with Putin is such he doesn't want to go there either.
Well, we would hope that he would be interested in protecting our electrical grid because it's incredibly important to our day-to-day lives, perhaps more so than who wins an election. I would just say that every year I spend about a month in the former Soviet Union on average for the last 12 years. I went on a Fulbright my first time to Moldova, and I learned a lot about Russian interference with individual politics, but also the power play for power. And by this I mean gas and electricity. And the Russians have used for years the threat of cutting off the gas supply in the winter as a way to encourage the Moldovans, the Georgians, the Azerbaijanis, the Ukrainians to comply with what Moscow wants. And for the entire time that I've been going, it has been Putin's desire to force into compliance former Soviet member states. And certainly he has as much of an interest in seeing the United States in some kind of subservient role. That is a desire that I think a lot of the Putin and his supporters want.
Jim,
what was interesting is that Fanning was saying that this entry point for Southern Company was actually happened in about 2014, and the origin was the Russian invasion of Ukraine and its seizure of Crimea, because one of the first things they did to cripple Ukraine during that period was they injected computer viruses into the management system for their power grid. And that has been taken as a lesson very closely. It's been very closely watched in the United States, because that's, you know, how we look at little wars to see how big wars are going to be fought in the future.
Yep.
That's it.
Well, The Hill this week was also reporting that it's not just Russia that's targeting our grid. Iran, there's also reported leaks that they've been able to trace back to Iran. So, you know, we're under siege from multiple directions.
Stacey, you would think this is a sort of issue that somebody would want to raise in a congressional race, Senate race, and yet it is interesting. This week it suddenly was a headline story, but it doesn't seem to have moved in a way that Russian meddling with the elections has.
Well, it's not as exciting as talking about Russians and hacking and meddling, and yep. Especially with the national media is only talking about that. So it's really hard for anything to catch on that's not in the national media spotlight, it seems.
But it has generated some discussion within at least one of those two races that we've got for the State Public Service Commission.
Yeah, that's right. You have Tricia Sidemore.
Pridemore.
She's the Republican incumbent, and she and Don Randolph, the Democrat, have kind of gotten into a discussion on this, on how a state should be prepared to deal with this.
Hopefully the PSC, the governor, the Southern Company, Georgia Power, others who are able to really be on the front lines of this, whether the media is paying attention or not, as long as those folks are paying attention, then I'll feel good that I'm going to be able to flip the light switch and light's going to come on.
All right. You know what I'd like to we have a lot more political, really, you know, the kind of real political stuff that I know a lot of you like to hear about today. For instance, there was a really interesting election in Tennessee overnight that may have some lessons to teach us about the cycle that we have coming up, the general election cycle we have coming up. We'll get to that. We're going to talk a little bit, I hope, about Michael Cohen, who, Jim Galloway, you reported in the Insider today that the $10 million deal that he cut to secure a nuclear power plant.
A loan of $5 billion.
Went to it was struck with a Chattanooga businessman.
Yeah, a Franklin Haney.
And if you're old enough,
you remember his footprints in Atlanta.
All right, we're going to talk about that and a lot more. Let's get a break out of the way, and we'll be back in a moment.
Why is the sun's corona hotter than its surface? Well, after years of speculating, NASA is sending a spacecraft straight to the source to find out. I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday for a look at what a new solar probe might discover as it gets up close and personal with the sun. Plus, can bacteria go extinct? It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Chris Grant is with us in Macon. Stacey Evans is here. By the way, Dee Dee Montgomery Murphy on Facebook Live says how glad she is to see you're on the show today, Stacey Evans. Loretta Lepore is with us, and so, of course, is Jim Galloway. Before we get to the Tennessee stories, Jim, a lot of people have been celebrating the fact that suddenly suburbanites in Atlanta are looking, suburban leaders and actual citizens are looking at the expansion of transit through MARTA. And the place everybody points to first is Gwinnett County, where suddenly there's an interest. But there's a slight hiccup now in the effort to get on the ballot a referendum for a one-penny sales tax. Talk about that. We'll discuss it.
Right. This is an initiative to among other things, it would create a heavy rail link from say maybe around Jimmy Carter and 85 down through DeKalb to downtown Atlanta and the airport. We've long considered Gwinnett's participation in MARTA, which this would be, is kind of the breakthrough. So they did approve a contract with MARTA, which was astounding and historic, and then they moved, instead of scheduling a vote for November 6th, the general election, where you're going to have a massive turnout in the county, they decided no, we're going to put it on move it to March 19th, 2019. That is a low turnout date. It's probably going to be more heavily Republican. Going to have older voters who are not likely to be commuters. It's going to be a much tougher lift for pro-transit forces.
As a result of that decision, I believe that MARTA has now put on hold finalizing the execution of the contract with Gwinnett County to see how that plays out. Am I not right?
Right. And to me, one of the most important things, implications of this is this moves the Gwinnett vote out of the realm of Nathan Deal, out of his tenure, and it moves it into the term of the next governor.
All right. So Stacey Evans, I think you can read the tea leaves on this any number of ways. And I'll propose one way to read it in a minute, but what's your take on this?
I was extremely disappointed for the voters of Gwinnett and for the state at large in the future of transit. First, we've got an all-Republican commission, supposedly fiscally conservative, picking an election date that's going to require an election that otherwise wouldn't be. More money.
Yeah, like
spent,
half a million bucks.
Extra money, extra time, extra manpower. And my guess and why they did it is that they were afraid this would rile up more Democratic voters to come out and vote, particularly in the 7th Congressional District, and they might lose that. That's very short-sighted because my take is they wouldn't have approved the contract, they wouldn't have gotten to this place if they didn't want the transit. And now they may have put the date on a date, the only date, that they might have ensure that they don't get the transit and cost the county money.
Yeah, let's remind our viewers and listeners that when you talk about that 7th District race, you've got Carolyn Bordeaux taking on Rob Woodall in a district that a lot of people feel could be in play because of the increasing Democratic voter base, which went for Hillary Clinton in the election. So, Loretta, let me throw this a different way to you, because you've been involved with chambers of commerce and consulting on issues on transportation and other. So let me read the tea leaves 180 degrees differently. It has been in some of these kinds of referenda, there's been a theory that lower turnout, if you can identify who your voters are, Charlotte Nash says she wants MARTA, the chair of the commission. If you can identify your voters and narrow cast to them in a low turnout election, you have a potential to get the result you want. My point is, you can spin this 180 degrees the other direction, that this is an effort to, in fact, get to assure that MARTA passes up there. How wrong am I?
Well, that's kind of like a mind twist there. I mean, historically, when you're putting, it takes a lot of work to get a referendum on the ballot to begin with. And this in particular, this situation with Gwinnett was addressed in the legislation, the new ATL legislation, that Gwinnett, in order for Gwinnett to continue on this path, they had to come to resolution by the end of this year. That was the provision they were given. Cobb was given a different provision,
right,
related to their community. And this particular transit package would provide the heavy rail that Jim talked about, but it would also provide a lot of bus transit within the county. In addition to Rob Woodall's race, you also have a number of highly contested state House and Senate races, right? In a county that is changing.
And two county commissioners up for reelection.
Right. And so you have some very heavily contested races in a place that is more purple than it has ever been before. And so the optics of it look very political. But typically, in the past, in all the referendum, when you look at the ones that occurred in Fulton and the city of Atlanta, you wanted high turnout. So you wanted it on a ballot, like a November ballot, where you had a lot of people going to the polls. And this November, there will be a lot of Democrats in Gwinnett turning out because they have more candidates in contested races.
So this is why you have been able to make a living as a political consultant off and on, and me, all I can do is host talk shows. Chris, weigh in on this, would you, the politics of it?
Oh, wow. I when I first came to Georgia in 1990, I remember one of the first things I was confronted with was a ballot initiative to expand MARTA. And I talked about it with my students at the University of Georgia at the time, and their contention was that the reason you didn't bring MARTA out to the suburbs is because it brought crime. And I said, yeah, every time I ride MARTA, I see someone carrying a television under one arm and a bag of golf clubs under the other. I said, really? I don't get that. I, of course, didn't necessarily understand what all the nuances of that were. To me, for Atlanta to continue on the economic growth engine that it is, it has to expand its transit opportunities. And it's not really something that Democrats favor against Republicans. I've got no number of Republicans that use mass transit in other cities. And I would imagine that's going to happen in Atlanta as well. But when transit becomes a bipartisan concern, I think we'll be in a better place altogether.
Well, and that's kind of the crux of this issue right now. Okay, in the race for governor, you've got Stacey Abrams, who's very, very much in favor of expanding commuter rail. On the Republican side, now you've got Brian Kemp. Now Nathan Deal he's been very, very vocal about tying economic development and transit together. Brian Kemp has been much less so. In fact, I got confirmed by his confirmation from his campaign this week. They say no, he has never endorsed an expansion of commuter rail for Georgia. That's a concern, and I just filed a Sunday column. I think it should be up right now. Yep. Kemp has got a meeting with the Metro Atlanta Chamber just to discuss this very point, to see what's going to be happening here.
Well, I actually was part of a debate, watching a debate between Kemp and Cagle rather, and they both duck questions about expansion of transit, which surprised me a little, but that was the primary election.
But if I could interrupt there a second, I think part of the point, and I watched that same conversation between the two of them during the debate, and part of it was when you're talking about transit today, it's not just rail, and in particular, not heavy rail. There are tons of different options today. And they did address bus rapid transit as a solution in some areas, yes, as we're seeing with 400. Brian Kemp did speak specifically to autonomous vehicles, which is part of MARTA's strategic planning, too. How do you use the technologies of the future and incorporate them into what you're doing today? We look at light rail. That has always been the option that the Beltline has wanted in the city of Atlanta. So there are a lot of different ways to be talking about transit today, and it can be a much more nuanced, productive conversation than just talking about heavy rail, which takes a minimum of 20 years to get done. And we've got a congestion problem today that needs to be resolved.
All right. So, by the way, Alan Fox, I think it is, Loretta, says there's nobody who knows more about transit than Loretta Lepore. Glad she's on the show today. Alan's watching on Facebook Live.
Well, thank you, Alan, but I can guarantee you there are.
All right. So we'll watch in the months ahead how that all plays out in the campaign that is undertaken to try to get MARTA passed up there. But again, one last note on that, Jim. The chair of the Gwinnett County Commission says she has absolutely no doubt that this will pass no matter when they take the vote.
Well, I guess the proof is going to be on, we'll see the proof on March 19th.
We'll hope.
All right. We had a number of elections in, primary elections in Tennessee. Jim, one of the elections that we spent some time looking at was the gubernatorial race up there. And we looked at it in part because you had a pro-Trump U.S. representative, Diane Black, who really wrapped herself in the Trump mantle. And in fact,
she had Mike Pence's endorsement.
Pence endorsed her very strongly. The president, not so much. He was a little bit more lukewarm about it. But there were videos of her sitting in the cabinet room with him that her campaign put out. A couple places where she was called out by the president at events with Republicans in Congress, and she got pretty soundly beaten in that race by a businessman who had no real political ties before. Once again, an outsider, name is Bill Lee, wins that race 37 to, you know, basically 23%. There was another candidate in there, but
and Lee kind of fits that businessman kind of practical slot that Tennessee picks for its representatives like Cork, like Bredesen, like who's the Hamby is the current governor, I think the term limited one,
huh?
Haslam,
yes,
Haslam, thank
you. Haslam, thank you. Is who's term limited.
Mm-hmm. So on one level that was it was unsurprising. On another level, on just after, given the fact that this is just a few days, a couple weeks after we went through a gubernatorial race where the race was turned upside down by Donald Trump.
Well, that's one of the reasons I thought it was worth bringing up. But I think, Stacey, this should in no way, again, because the president wasn't all in on this race, despite the fact his vice president was. Yeah, I don't. This isn't necessarily a sign that Trump's popularity in Tennessee. He may have some issues in the general election.
Well, I wish it was a sign that Trump's popularity was falling more in the South, but I don't think you can read that in there at all. I think all four of the candidates in the Republican primary in the Tennessee governor's race embrace Trump. I think you had this businessman, Mr. Lee, that was Trump-like, in an outsider, a businessman. So just because the other folks were saying rah rah Trump, this guy was probably more Trump-like than any of the other ones, and so I don't think you need to read much into it. Trump did immediately endorse Bob Lee, and so I think he'll very much be in play there, just like he'll be in play here. So it'll be interesting to see.
On the other side of that race, Chris, Carl Dean was running against Craig Fitzhugh. Fitzhugh is the minority leader, I believe, in the Tennessee State House. And the reason I think, and he got shellacked. I mean, Craig Fitzhugh got shellacked, 75-19%.
Let's be nicer on the shellacking language. These are the people behind these shellackings, you know.
Stacey Evans, since you are with us today,
I kid.
I know, we'll say, didn't have the outcome
that you
that
desired.
He had hoped for. And, but what's interesting about that to me, Chris, and I wonder if there's any application to Georgia here, although this was a Democratic primary, Fitzhugh was a pretty strong liberal. He really ran on a very liberal platform, and voters in Tennessee rejected it. It's interesting here in Georgia, Stacey Abrams ran a fairly liberal race. Stacey Evans ran a more conservative race, and the outcome was completely different. What do you make of that?
I think Georgia and Tennessee are two different states with two different political bases in each of their parties. And I would also suggest that there's another – what I was really interested in Tennessee was expecting Dianne Black to win the primary for governor and to see Marsha Blackburn running for the U.S. Senate. Very similar positions, different styles. And I was wondering how that would affect a voter that was going to go in, and were they going to split their votes for the governor and the senator in that situation. What I think you get out of this is that each race is different. Each race is an individual competition between candidates that put forward their best, and voters respond for a variety of reasons, some of which are ideological and some of which have nothing to do with ideology.
In Tennessee, a lot of it is about geography. There are basically three states in Tennessee.
In both parties, there are three states.
So it's going to be interesting to watch. Yeah, Stacey Evans, jump in.
Well, and one thing to say about this Democratic contest, from all I've read, there was a significant money advantage on the side of the gentleman who won, whose name escapes me right now.
Carl Dean.
You can't underestimate the role that money plays in campaigns. The one who won in Tennessee spent the most money. The one who won here in Georgia spent the most money. This happens. I think what we've got set up, though, is a very interesting dynamic in two southern states. Tennessee, Georgia certainly have their differences, but the Democratic candidate going forward in the governor's race in Tennessee certainly staked out unapologetically a more moderate position. The Democratic candidate in Georgia staked out an unapologetically more progressive stance. And so we'll see how those two strategies play
out
in the general elections.
I think that's going to be really interesting to watch. We are out of time for today's show. I'm sorry to say. Chris Grant, thank you for joining us from Macon. Loretta Lepore, we always love it, having you here on Fridays.
Thank you.
See you again next Friday on Political Rewind. Galloway, you'll be back on Monday show. Stacey Evans, it's really terrific to have you. Will you come back and join us?
I would
us?
Love to come back. It's been great to be here. Thank
Good.
You.
Good. So that's it. We're basically out of time for today's show. A couple things to remind you of, as if you haven't heard this enough. We are on the air now 4 days a week, so that means next week you'll be able to watch Rewind on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday. Next Tuesday, Jim Galloway, your boss, Kevin Riley, says he's going to come and talk about politics with us. You want me to ask him anything on your behalf while he's here?
No. Well, it's almost raise time.
Yeah, that's
it's
what I had in mind. All right. That's about it for us. Thank you all again very much for being with us for another week of Political Rewind. We'll see you again here on Monday. Take care.